Hello and shalom. Welcome to this episode of Image Bearers Radio. I'm your host, Joe Amon. We got a great show ahead, so buckle up and hang on. Here we go. Hey guys, shalom, shalom. Welcome to this episode of Image Bearers Radio. I'm your host, Joe Amon, coming to you all the way from Out of Ashes Ministries in Southwest Louisiana, located right outside of DeRidder, Louisiana. And I hope you guys are doing incredibly well. Welcome to episode 145 of IBR. You'll notice if you stick around, we have a lot of like little abbreviations for stuff, IBR, OAM, all the things. It's all good. So glad that you guys are here with us. Excited about what we have to talk about, continuing on from last week's episode. So if you have not caught episode 144, please go back and do that because you're going to need it for this episode. So hey, is it your first time checking us out? Maybe you're watching us on YouTube or listening on Hebrew Nation Online or catching us on your favorite podcast provider, wherever it is. If you're just stopping by and getting involved with Image Bearers Radio, thank you guys so very much for stopping by. I hope you enjoy the conversation. And subscribe and become a part of the community. Also, if you're checking us out on a podcast provider, especially like iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever it's called now, hey, rate us. Give us a review. It'd be really cool if you're on Google Podcasts. Write a review for us. It'd be awesome just to see what you guys are thinking and how you're enjoying the podcast. If you don't know, Image Bearers Radio is an extension of Out of Ashes Ministries, which is a Yeshua-centered, Torah-pursuant, Torah-observant Sabbath fellowship here in Southwest Louisiana. So if you're in the area, if you're in Southwest Louisiana, Central Louisiana, East Texas, we have folks that drive from up to two and a half hours away for Shabbat service. We'd love to see you guys sometime in person. But if you are anywhere else out in the internet regions, in the vast expanses of the internet, we do live stream our Shabbat services every Shabbat at 10 a.m. Central. And you can go to our website, outofashesministries.org/live, and you can find us there, or you can also check us out. We multi-stream to Facebook and YouTube every week, and so we'd love to see you there. For those of you guys that are longtime followers and listeners and you've been around for a little while, thank you so much, guys, for making an awesome community. Thank you for sticking with us, for sharing these episodes, and I would ask you to share them if you do find them helpful and challenging and just good information or whatever. Share them. Let's get the word out about what we're talking about, and hopefully we're talking about some things that not a lot of other people in this movement are talking about. It just adds to the overall growth and maturity of us as the kingdom people, image-bearing people all together. The other thing I want to ask you guys to do is if you would, just please consider partnering with us financially. In addition to sharing the episodes and getting the word out there, financial donations is a huge part. I don't want to be that guy that's always asking for money. That's not what this is about. But there are a lot of things that I would love to do at this podcast and radio show. And so if you would help support, you can go to our website, outofashesministries.com/give, and you can either give a one-time donation, you can do something that's recurring if you'd like to, $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever it would be super, super helpful. And we really, really would appreciate it. So what are we doing today? This week, we are going to continue on with last week's episode talking about the Sanhedrin and the question of rabbinic authority. I know, ooh, clickbaity title, right? No, but it's a lot of fun. I love talking about this. So let us go to the Father in prayer and ask him to bless this time together, and then we will get into this week's episode. Avinu Malkinu, our Father and King, we bless you, Father, and we thank you for this time together. I thank you, God, that we have access to so much information, things that our teachers and forefathers could not even dream of having. And we pray, Father, that as we take in this information, you make us better image bearers in our world. Amen and amen. Everybody. So we are continuing our talk with Sanhedrin. Now, last week, Again, this is still part of the big series, the What Do You Want series. So last week, we read a bunch of scripture. We read in Shemot. We read in Devarim. We read in Bamidbar. Bamidbar and Devarim. Excuse me. I'll get it in the right order. Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy about the establishment of judges and what would become kind of the seedbed or the foundation for the great Sanhedrin, which is where we get all of the rulings in Jewish oral law, in halakha. And so the reason why this is important, again, is because this is part of our bigger series on What Do You Want? And one of the things that we are going to explore in this is how a better, a more studious, a more accurate, I'm trying to think of some other words, just an overall better keeping of the Torah. How does that affect who we are? How does that change our identity? How does that make our make us better image bearers? How does that create the fullness of the stature of Messiah in us? And if we, again, because we say, talked about this last week, but we kind of pride ourselves on being Torah keepers, but how well do you keep it? How well do you know it? Is your observance and is your keeping of the Torah more involved than it was last year? Is it better? Is it more informed? Is it full of more wisdom? Is it full of more joy because you understand things better this year? So all of these questions are things that I think can be answered, and hopefully we will answer as we kind of make our way to studying the mitzvot in detail, or at least beginning to study them. And so we are reading about Mosaic succession and about how Moshe taught the elders and he passed on to Joshua, and Joshua taught the elders. And we're reading out of Pirkei Avot, out of the Mishnah. If you have a Siddur, any Siddur that you have, Pirkei Avot is there. Hey, you got Google, right? You got it on your phone right now. Right now, why don't you Google or Safari or whatever thingamabobber you have, and just Google Pirkei Avot. And there you go. It'll find it. We're only going to read the first two Mishnahot, the first two paragraphs, as it were. And so it says, Moshe received the Torah at Sinai. Right? Everybody agree? We're good there, right? And transmitted it to Joshua. Joshua to the elders. Again, we talked about last week how Moses chose these elders, but, you know, elders do what elders do, like what people do. They die, and so they're replaced, and so there has to be this constant system of educating the elders on past rulings, on tradition, on all these kinds of things. One of the things that we don't think about when it comes to, you know, Torah and the operating of Israel, ancient Israel, one we talked about last week, and that's in vigilante justice. We don't think about the court system. We don't think about, you know, how stringent testimonies and all these, you know, all these things were. They were very stringent. We're gonna learn that in the next couple of weeks. And so, one of the things, all other things that we don't think about is we don't think about the idea of the high level of judicial practice. In other words, you know, you think about, you know, you watch the news or whatever, and you have a legal case that's happening in the country, and you have expert lawyers that come on, and the things that they talk about, none of us ever think about, right? We don't ever think about it. We don't study it. We don't, some of the words they use are kind of like, what? But we don't ever, like, it's not a part of our everyday life. They're involved in a really niche area that they spend way more time studying, way more money and all that than we ever would dream about. Like, we're busy living our lives, doing our thing, right? But this is what they've chosen to do. It's what they're gifted at. And what we forget is that if not for them, the order of our nation would break down. Now, you may want to argue that it's already down, and I would not disagree with you. It would go through even further breakdown, right? Where we would just have absolutely no rule of law. And your small town lawyers, you know, you live in a town of, you know, 20,000 people, 60,000 people, 5,000 people. You don't even have a lawyer in your town. You got to go to the next town, whatever. Even those small town, you know, what we would call small time lawyers, are they're part of custodians of really law and order, right? If you think about if your local law office, somebody you went to school with, or a kid of somebody you went to school with, or one of your children or whatever, maybe they just deal in like civil law, right? And they just deal in marriages and divorces and, you know, lawsuits and that kind of stuff. There are still custodians of order. And it's super important. You go like, yeah, but that's not a spiritual thing. No, that's highly spiritual. It's incredibly spiritual. Because the kingdom is all about bringing order to chaos, right? And so, you know, we don't think about the high level of judicial mechanics and thought in ancient Israel. But the Torah, the covenant, is a legal document. We talked in our Kedusha lessons that Kedusha, we define Kedusha as set apart for the service of God through legal restrictions and limitations, legal and formal restrictions and limitations. Well, that's that legal word is a big word there, right? That presumes some kind of law, some kind of judgment, some kind of precedent, and assumes a right and a responsibility. And you can argue that part of when humanity really gets in trouble, as Israel got in trouble, is that they enjoyed the rights without upholding the responsibility, right? If you have rights with no responsibility, you have illegitimate rights. If all you have is responsibility and no rights, then you have illegitimate responsibility, which basically makes you a slave, right? So these things balance each other. Rights and responsibilities balance each other. Our authority and responsibility, we've talked about before, balance each other. So we're told that that Joshua passed these things on, the teaching of Moses, the instruction of Moses, as we read last week, to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly. Now, the men of the great assembly, as we said, left off last week, are those who are helping to put the nation, the Jewish people, those that came back from exile, trying to put that nation back together. After the Babylonian exile, Ezra and Nehemiah came back, started to rebuild the temple, etc. The men of the great assembly are those that came and were integral in putting the nation back together. I don't know how we read the Bible and how you read the Bible, but I like to think about the really nuts and bolts part of the narrative that the Bible is telling. I think that's for me, it's a really good habit to get into, because everything can seem kind of fantasy, kind of storybook, kind of, like in Sunday school growing up, we had felt boards, where it's like a little white pasty Jesus on a felt board and you stuck him up there, and there's Zacchaeus in the tree and the thing. But we tend to think of it as kind of not real. And so when Ezra and Nehemiah, the decree is given by Cyrus for the children of Israel to come back, for the Jewish people to come back, and Ezra and Nehemiah come back, they come back to a temple that is ruined. They come back to a land that has had inhabitants move in and filled the vacuum of when the northern tribe is gone and replaced with Assyrian transplants, and so there's foreigners in the land. Then Judah comes back, they come back into Judea, and there's other people there, and they're asking themselves, look at our land, our once great, and golden land, that the land of promise of our forefathers, and all these things, and they're remembering the Torah and remembering the land of milk and honey and the report of the spies and Moshe and all these things, and it's like, who are we? So not only is their land destroyed, their temple is destroyed, but their own identity is destroyed, and going, how did we get here, and how do we never come back to this place? So there is a lot of mechanics that go. Ezra and Nehemiah don't just do it on their own, right? There are the story, record in Chronicles tells us that there are all these priestly families that come back and they're helping rebuild the temple, and there's all these other families that come back and they're rebuilding the walls, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And so, I'm sorry, in Nehemiah. And so these men of the great assembly are part of the judgments, the system of judges, part of the legal sphere of Israel that has to come back, and they have to start making judgments about what do we do about certain things, right? And so you have the men of the great assembly. And in the beginning of Pirkei Avot, it says they said three things. So the ethic of the men of the great assembly, kind of their thing was, be patient in the administration of justice. Now this and the next, this one should kind of recall, if you listened to last week's episode, we talked about the idea that, you have this pervading idea in Christianity and some of our backgrounds that like the Torah is all about vigilante justice, right? You see someone worshiping at an Asherah pole, or you know someone's caught in idolatry. You and one other person know, and you just drag them into the gate, and you just pick up the nearest stone, and you just start hitting them right with rocks. And we talked last week about, you know, like, when we tell people we follow the law, we follow the Torah, one of the first questions that sometimes you'll get is like, well, do you stone your children? And like, they may be smart people, but they're really ignorant in Torah law, right? And how the whole Torah works. And that's not the way it is. The Torah always, and the way that the sages and these judges always erred on the side of mercy. That's going to be a huge thing that we're going to learn. They err on the side of mercy always, okay? And so, one of the things of the men of the Great Assembly was be patient in the administration of justice. Take your time. Make sure that you're getting it right, okay? Secondly, raise many disciples. Raise many disciples. So you go like, well, you know, we hear Yeshua going like, Yeshua has disciples. Do all rabbis have disciples? How long is discipleship a thing? Well, it's from the men of the Great Assembly who were, you know, 7th, 8th century. That's way too long. You're talking about, 6th, 7th century BCE or BC. So you're talking about a long time before even Yeshua comes on the scene, before even rabbis come on the scene. And lastly, make a fence round the Torah. Oh, man, I love this one, and some of you guys are going to hate this one. Make a fence around the Torah. This is the idea of, like, the speed limit's 55, right? Now, you could do 55, but what about doing 52 or 53 just because? Or it's like, well, why don't we have cruise control? Cruise control, you know, can be for lazy people like me that don't like to hold their foot on the pedal, but can also be a safety precaution that you go, okay, I'm setting it at this, bang, there it is, and make sure I don't go on. It's a fence, right? We have a lot of fences in our lives, and yet we get all offended whenever we put fences around the Torah. And it's just not, it's hypocritical a little bit. Then it says, Shimon the Righteous, or Shimon HaTzadik, was one of the last of the men of the Great Assembly. He used to say, I love these, the world stands upon three things, the Torah, the temple service, and the practice of acts of piety. So the Torah, the temple service, which I love it, it's kind of like the center of the cosmos, and on the practice of piety. In other words, doing the things. That's what piety is doing the things, right? And so we have Moses, we have Joshua, we have the elders to the prophets to the men of the Great Assembly, Shimon HaTzadik being the last of the men of the Great Assembly. Okay, so that takes us from the giving of Torah at Sinai, all the way through to the return from the exile. Okay, and then we have leading up through Antiochus and the Greeks and the Maccabees and all of that, right? You have the last one of that men of Great Assembly being Shimon HaTzadik. And then you have in those silent years, what we call them between the testaments, you had the formation of this thing called the Zugot, Z-U-G-G-O-T, the Zugot. And the Zugot were pairs of leaders of the Sanhedrin. They were the president, or the Nasi in Hebrew, and the Av Beit Din, or the father of the house of judgment. And so you have the Nasi and the Av Beit Din, and though that pair is called a Zugot. Now, interesting that Zugot kind of sounds an awful lot like zygote, which I think is cool. And I mean, there's no, like, I don't know that there's any real, like, you know, teeth to this, but it's this idea of this pair that kind of produces life. And really, in essence, it does, because, again, these are those that are upholding the order of Israelite society, okay? Of the most popular, most famous of these Zugot, this pair of leaders, are people that you've heard of before. And this is going into now the just before the first century, just before the time of Yeshua. They are Hillel and Shammai. I'm sure you've heard about Hillel and Shammai. There are some wonderful stories about Hillel and Shammai. I've said this before. I personally believe that Yeshua, while maybe not a, might have been a formal disciple of Hillel, of Beit Hillel, I definitely believe he definitely took a lot of wisdom and a lot of the yoke of Hillel. I think Yeshua really respected and thought a lot of Hillel. And so what's important to understand is that Hillel and Shammai are both Pharisees. They're both Prushim. And within the Pharisaic world, there are like seven different sects of Pharisees, especially as we get into the first century. And so Hillel and Shammai are Pharisees. They have two almost completely different ways of seeing and applying the Torah, which is, it should, you know, when we talk about, when we read the Gospels and we talk about, oh, well, the Pharisees, and then we have modern day understandings, you talk to a modern day believer and you go, well, the Pharisees were all hypocrites. And you go, that's literally impossible. There's just no way that could be. I'm sorry, it can't happen that way. Because we see Hillel and Shammai are two of the most prominent Pharisees ever, and they within themselves had differences. And so you have a world of Phariseeism, right? Hillel, Shammai, and they are leading the Sanhedrin. And Hillel has his own school called Beit Hillel. Shammai has his own school called Beit Hillel. Then after Hillel and Shammai, you have this Rabban, Gamliel, and anytime you see the title Ramban with an N, it indicates he's a president. He's the president of the Sanhedrin. So you have Gamaliel, and you have descendants of Hillel, until we get to Yochanan ben Zakkai towards the very end of the great Sanhedrin. Now, so the Sanhedrin is a great, if you want to look this up, look up the Wikipedia article on Sanhedrin. It's really pretty good. I think you can gain a lot of context and a lot of understanding kind of just through reading the Wikipedia article. So I'm going to read a couple portions of it. And I told you, remember, that the elders, the leaders, and all of this weren't called in the wilderness. They weren't called the Sanhedrin. The men of the great assembly were not called the Sanhedrin, and there's a probably a good practical reason for that. At least this is the way I understand it and the way I like to teach it. And it comes from the first paragraph of this Wikipedia article. It says the Sanhedrin is a Greek word, synedrion. Okay, synedrion means sitting together, or assembly, or council. So just from a really practical standpoint, one of the reasons why we don't hear of the Sanhedrin until the pre-first century, until, you know, the first century BC, or second century BC, is because it's a Greek word. And so it's called things like the elders, the judges, the men of the great assembly. It's called other things. It's not called Sanhedrin. So people will say, well, yeah, you know, I mean, you're trying to teach the Sanhedrin thing, but don't you know that the Sanhedrin didn't even exist until around the time of the Maccabees? And you go like, no, that's actually not, it wasn't called the Sanhedrin, but it's the same functioning body. And so what you can do is you can go back to Pirkei Avot, and we're going to end up doing this at some point. But if you go back to Pirkei Avot, you see Shimon HaTzadik, right, where we left off in number two. And then you go to number three, and it says Antigonus. And then you go to number four, and it says Yose ben Yozer. And then Yose ben Yohanan, and then Yeshua ben Pariah, and then Natai. And it goes Shimon ben Setach, and Shemaiah. And then it's C in 12 there, it says Hillel and Shammai. And then it's Rabban Gamliel, right? And so you can see we have this beautiful lineage. We have this beautiful transmission. And again, remember, very important, what is being transmitted is Mosaic succession. That's what's happening, Shmicha, authority that comes from Moses. And so maybe you have heard before, you know, this thing where, well, the rabbis think that they, you know, they're in Mosaic succession, or, you know, you've heard things like that maybe, now I want, the reason why I'm going through all this, you know, maybe boring, the reason I'm going through this is because I want you to actually see where it comes from. I don't want you to just go, well, like, oh, the rabbis think. No, I want you to understand why they think that, all right? All right, we're going to be right back after the break. Don't go away. See you in a second. All right, guys, welcome back. So, very important. I know we say things like, well, the, you know, people that are anti-rabbinic or, you know, don't really believe that they should live the way that, you know, the rabbinical Judaism says, whatever. They go like, oh, the rabbis, they believe erroneously that they have Mosaic succession. No, like, this is where it is. This is where it comes from. I've just shown you what they understand to be their rabbinic succession. Now, we will talk about this at some point when we finish this up, but when we say the rabbis, who are we talking about when we say the rabbis? Well, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that as we start to talk about the oral law and stuff. But just suffice to say, whenever most people who know what they're talking about talk about the rabbis, the people that they're talking about, also called the sages, also called the Tanaim, these are the people that are around from the time of the men of the Great Assembly on through to the time of Hillel and Shammai, and then they things kind of start to develop from there. And so when we talk about the rabbis or the sages, say, we're talking about those people, not Rabbi so-and-so, you know, from, you know, the Bronx or from, you know, the next town over. The modern rabbi, the question is, well, you know, should we follow modern rabbis? Well, what I think is important is that if you're genuinely serious about this topic, what I think is important is that we learn to study what the modern rabbis have grown up studying, which is Mishnah, Talmud, right? Oral writings, our oral Torah, the writings of the sages, etc. We start to study what they study, and you can now. We have this awesome resource called Safaria, right? You got Safaria. You can look. I don't know if you've ever seen Safaria, but just so I can show you real quick. You've got Safaria. Look, the text tab. Look, you've got the Tanakh. You've got the Mishnah. You've got the Talmud, right? You got the Parsha each week. You've got something called Daf Yomi. Daf Yomi is means a page a day, and it takes about 7 years to do it, but it takes you through a page of the Talmud every day and explains it. Like, you got Midrash, you got Halakha, the legal works providing guidance on all aspects of Jewish life, i.e. living the Torah. You've got Kabbalah, you've got liturgy, which is your Siddur and things like that. You've got thought, Jewish thought, philosophy. You've got the Tosefta, which is a companion to the Mishnah. You've got Chassidut, Musar. You've got Responsa, which is Responsa is fantastic. When rabbis respond to difficult topics and the application of like where the Torah meets real life, and rabbis have to respond to those kinds of things. You got Second Temple. I mean, just look at the stuff, right? Reference, dictionaries, encyclopedias, lexicons, all these kind of wonderful things that we have available to us. So as we start to study what the rabbis study and we start to get familiar with it, then when you hear a modern day rabbi, then you can know, like, okay, that dude's just drawing from the same well as everybody. He's drawing from the same rabbinic works that I know about, that I've read. And you can start to spot the, you know, the ones that are worth following and then the ones that maybe don't speak in a way that, you know, is good for you or that you understand. Okay, so that's kind of my ideas on that. Okay, so getting back to the Wikipedia article. I'm sorry, we took a massive rabbit trail there. So Sanhedrin is a Greek word, okay? That's why it doesn't show up until later. It's a Greek word, Sanhedrion. And so the Wikipedia article says that it means sitting together, which where we get the idea of an assembly or a council, right? And it was an assembly of 23 to 71 men appointed in every city in the land of Israel. Now, those things need some a little bit of explaining. It was either 23 or 71, and it was not in every city in the land of Israel, but we'll talk about that kind of as we move along. Moving on, it says the Great Sanhedrin was made up of a Nasi, Again, we're going to learn to understand when it says the great Sanhedrin, we're not talking about the men of the great assembly. We're talking about an adaptation of the law, the council of the Sanhedrin and these elders and leaders. We're talking about how it has kind of adapted through the time. When you see the term great Sanhedrin, you know the period of time you're talking about is after the men of the great assembly and before the destruction of the temple or little after the destruction of the temple. Okay, you're talking about like pre-Yeshua by a few decades, a century or so maybe, up to after about a century after the destruction of the temple. So you're talking about that couple of hundred years, okay? So the great Sanhedrin, that's the time frame we're in, was made up of a Nasi, who functioned as head or representing president, but was not a member of the court. You'll understand that a little bit later. And Av Beit Din, the chief of the court, and 69 general members. Okay, we get this from Numbers chapter 27, verse 23. It says, in the second temple period, the great Sanhedrin met in the hall of hewn stones, which is also called Lishkat Hagazit in Hebrew, in the temple in Jerusalem. The court convened every day except festivals and Shabbat. In the late 3rd century, to avoid persecution, its authoritative decisions were issued under the name Beit HaMidrash. So I want to show you really quickly. Last week we did this, and I think it worked out decently well. And so I want to show you where they're meeting in the temple, because this is really important. This is going to kind of piggyback on some stuff that we talked about last week and through the Kedusha things. And so if we go over here to the iPad, I'll show you guys where we are. So you can see that, so we are in the Ezrat Nashim, or the Court of the Women, okay? I hope some of you will get this app and so, you know, and kind of start to study and learn where we are and what we're doing. I'm sorry, I keep jumping. And so we're going to go up here, and I want to show you where Lishkat Hagazit, or the Hall of Hewn Stone. We can get there a couple different ways. We're going to go up here. We're going to go through the Nicanor Gate, and we are going to end up in, if you'll remember from last week, Ezrat Israel, the Court of Israel. And we're going to come over here to the building called Beit Avtinas, and you can see here we have the kior, or the brazen laver, where the Kohanim wash their hands and feet. And then we go through in this door here, and this is called Lishkat Hagazit. This is the Hall of Hewn Stone. And you can see, we're going to read about this later, but I just want you to see it for now. You see the seating arrangement is kind of like a stadium seating kind of deal, where the elders all sat together. These tables are here to represent the kind of the court stenographers, the record keepers that recorded all of these things. And so I just want to show you really quickly, if we go out this way, here we are. If you watched last week's episode, this is the chael, the raised platform, and this little wall down here is called the soreg, right? And so if we look at it from an overview, or from an overhead view, rather, you can see, I know it's a little hard with all these labels, but you see here it says Chamber of Hewn Stone. So you see where we are in the temple. This is the temple building, and you can see we are on the southeastern corner of the temple building, and that's where the Chamber of Hewn Stone is, right? So I just wanted you to be able to see kind of where they meet. It's a cool visual, I think, always. I'm very visual, so it's cool for me to kind of get to see, learn better like that. All right, so our Wikipedia article goes on to say, historically, the last binding decision of the Great Sanhedrin appeared in 358 CE. So you're 3rd century CE, right? So you're 300 years. It says, when the Hebrew calendar was adopted. Oh, man, this is great, because we're in a time right now where there's a lot of consternation about the Hebrew calendar, right? The Aviv search, and when is Pesach, and the beginning of the year, and Nisan, and blah, 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 and everybody's all hair on fire. Ah, we're going to get it wrong, blah, 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 etc. So it says this adoption of the Hillel calendar, the calculated calendar, was the last official act of the Great Sanhedrin. Now, have you ever studied why? What is the deal with the calculated calendar? And why? It says the Sanhedrin was dissolved after continued persecution by the Roman Empire and aspiring Christendom. Over the centuries, there have been attempts to revive the institution, such as the Grand Sanhedrin, convened by Napoleon Bonaparte. Did you know about that? Interesting. And modern attempts in Israel. Okay, so the calendar thing we'll talk about again later, but just let me give you the Cliff Notes version real quick. I'll give you the TLDR, too long, didn't read version. The ancient calendar in the Second Temple period was a sighted moon. They sighted the moon. Witnesses came up to the Hall of Hewn Stone, to Lishkat HaGazit. Ezra the scribe, it says, had a chamber there where the high priest or the lived, and he had in that chamber in the Hall of Hewn Stone, he had depictions of different phases of the moon. And a witness would come up and say, "I spotted the new moon, and I'm here to testify, I'm to witness about it." And so they would take him in there and say, "What did you see? Point to what you saw. Show us. Was the sun before, moon after? You know, wherever." Again, we'll read all this in detail later. And you say, "I saw this." I'm like, "Okay, great." And then they'll send him out and bring in another witness who hadn't heard his testimony. And once they find two witnesses that match, then they can declare Rosh Chodesh, the new month, the renewal of the month, renewal of the moon. And that is what happened. Now, as the Sanhedrin and the all parts of Judaism got increasingly threatened by Rome and by Christianity, the witnesses, it became too dangerous for the witnesses to come and testify about Rosh Chodesh. Now, it is a commandment that we declare and that we recognize and celebrate Rosh Chodesh. It's a commandment. It's a Torah commandment. So it is important that that is done. But if it threatens life, there has to be a way, because Torah is about life. And God, and this is so important to understand. See, it's easy for us to make all of these criticisms and stuff on Judaism and go, "Well, they should have never done, the Torah doesn't have a calculated calendar, blah, 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 blah." Well, but what you don't understand is that people's lives were at risk in order to fulfill the Torah commandment of sighting the new moon. So is God about God's law, period, even if it costs people their lives? Listen, this is not the God's Not Dead movie, okay? This is not the story of the shootings in Columbine. This is a different time and a different place, and we have to understand the way that they made their decisions, okay? The pikuach nefesh, the saving of life, was the ideal. That was the priority. And so in an attempt to not have witnesses killed, robbed, beaten, threatened, to come up and sanctify the new moon, they went to a calculated calendar, which was done by Hillel. Okay, that's the short and skinny. Again, that's the TLDR version. We will get to the details in subsequent weeks. Okay, so we have in, let me show you this real quick, because I want you to, here's the deal. Why are you showing us all this stuff? I'm listening. I can't see it. I know. It's fine. But hopefully you can go back and watch the YouTube video. It'll be linked in the audio episodes. But I want you to have access to these resources, guys. I want you to be able to have access so you can go and see. One of my biggest issues is teachers that say, "Well, the rabbis say," and then they tell you something, which usually is half of what it says, and it's usually not even the right context, and then they just move on, and they never tell you where to go and look at that for yourself. I don't want to be guilty of that. I got sick and tired of that from some teachers, which is why I stopped following some teachers years ago, because I wanted to know where they were getting this stuff from. I wanted to read it to myself. Listen, I was upset because I felt like I'd been lied to in church. I wasn't going to be lied to by more teachers. Let me read it for myself, and I'll decide whether or not it's valid, okay? So, if you go here to Safaria, and this is on the iPad, but it comes, you can do it on a web browser as well, online. And look, if you go to Mishnah, we'll end up talking about this again later on. But if you go down to Seder Nezakin, Seder Nezakin right here. And you go down, here's Mishnah Sanhedrin. This is how the Sanhedrin works. I'm just going to scroll, see, all this. So, hey, listen, this is all I'm asking. Instead of making ignorant comments about the Sanhedrin, before you start saying they did this and they believe that and whatever, listen, look, I'm still scrolling. Go read all this, okay? Go study Mishnah Sanhedrin. And then, look, if you go back and you go to the Talmud, and you go again down to Seder Nezikin, which Nezikin means damages, so it's an appropriate place for the Sanhedrin, and you click on Sanhedrin, look, you're going to get, this is what the Mishnah says. See it up there at the top? And then it'll go down, and it'll say in verse 3, the rabbis say, right? And so you have this, that's the Gemara, that's the discussion. So I want you to have access to this information, okay? And I'm just going to ask you to do something really mature and really, you know, really, I think, grown up. And that is, if you, you know, if you don't know about a topic, then don't say anything about it. Just go like, I haven't really researched that. Because research doesn't mean looking up verses in a concordance and then finding a YouTube video that agrees with what you think. That's not research. Research is reading every available resource that you can find, that you have access to, and then taking some time to think about and process it before you draw a conclusion. And then that conclusion then is strictly just your opinion on what you have read. It's how you see what you have read. That's how research works. All right, so it says the Talmud, this is just from some notes I have, the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin identifies two classes of rabbinical courts called Sanhedrin, a great Sanhedrin, also called Sanhedrin HaGedolah, and a lesser Sanhedrin called Sanhedrin HaKatana. You will know these words maybe if you have a talit. If you have a great big talit, right, that you wrap yourself in, or that you, a great big talit is called a talit gadol, right, a great talit. And if you sang the song Gadol Elohai, Gadol, how great, right, great is our God. And if you wear a talit, if you wear a tzitzit with a talit you wear, like an undershirt, that is called a talit katan. So you have Sanhedrin HaGedolah, and you have Sanhedrin HaKatana. It says each city could have its own lesser Sanhedrin of 23 judges. So the lesser Sanhedrin, Katana, has 23 judges. Sanhedrin HaGedolah has 71. Each city could have its own lesser Sanhedrin of 23 judges, but there could only be one great Sanhedrin. And there's a way that you determine how which cities get a lesser Sanhedrin we'll talk about. The great Sanhedrin of 71 acted as Supreme Court, taking appeals from cases that were decided by lesser courts, sound familiar? And the number of judges were predicated on eliminating the possibility of a tie, and to cast their vote with the last one to cast the vote was the head of the court. So we're going to look at the makeup of the court in a couple of weeks or next week, and I think you're going to find that really interesting. This is just an overview. We're just kind of getting our feet, our toes dipped into the whole idea. The Sanhedrin, as a body, claimed powers that lesser Jewish courts did not have. Again, think of Supreme Court in our day. As such, they were the only ones that could try the king. So they're the only ones that were qualified to try the king if necessary. They were the only ones that could extend the boundaries of the temple and of Jerusalem. They were the only ones to whom the questions of final halakha were finally put. So if there was debates about how do we do these things, they worked their way up through the courts. The great Sanhedrin, HaGedolah, was the only one that could finally say, this is the ruling on how we do things. And so on that point, let me just say, you know, if someone has issues with how the Jews do things, or how the court rules, or how, you know, the authority of Great Sanhedrin, and understand that these decisions came up through lesser courts. So it's not like the Great Sanhedrin is just making stuff up. Similar to our Supreme Court, we have a case right now before the Supreme Court about presidential immunity, and I think this is a kind of a beautiful parallel. We have a case before the Supreme Court about presidential immunity. Does the president have blanket immunity over that it covers either private acts, official acts? They're thinking probably not, definitely not private acts, but official acts maybe. And then what is the coverage of immunity over official acts? There's all these questions, and they all have really profound ramifications. So What the consensus seems to be, and we haven't made a ruling yet, but what it seems to be is that the Supreme Court is going to throw it back to lower courts so that they can kind of get through the milieu of what is being discussed, And then if it needs to come back up to the Supreme Court, then they'll handle it then. But several of the judges, both, you know, liberal and conservative, left and right, have said, we don't want to make some kind of sweeping decision, some kind of sweeping generalization that has profound and unnecessary or unwanted complications down the road. And so that's a really good insight, I think, into kind of the role of Sanhedrin Gadolah, is this idea that any decisions that they made regarding Halakha is because it bubbled up from the lesser courts and it was hashed out through lesser courts and finally came to the Sanhedrin. So I hope that's some helpful kind of context to what we're talking about here. Okay. So before 191 BC, so this is the men of the Great Assembly, okay? The high priest acted as ex officio head of the Sanhedrin. So this is the men of the Great Assembly. During that time frame, this is after return of exile, right? This is Maccabee time, Greeks, and all that kind of stuff, right? But in 191 BC, thereabouts, the Sanhedrin lost confidence in the high priest, and the office of Nasi was created. Now, if you know the answer to this, I would be super proud of you. Okay, so what things are happening around 191, around the second century BC, that would contribute to a loss of confidence in the Kohen Gadol as the leader of the Sanhedrin? I'll give you a minute. No, I won't. Okay, because some people listen to audio, like, what are you doing to me? So think about what happens now. What happens during Hanukkah, right? This is mid-300s. You think about Hanukkah, what happens, right? The Hasmoneans win, the Maccabees win. Yay, go Hasmoneans. And in less than 100 years, which takes us up to about 200 BC, mid-200s BC, what happens is that the Maccabees, who are priests, their sons become the high priests, they begin to be Hellenized, right? And they begin to really move and shake with Greece and then with Rome, and there's all this compromise and all these things. And so that's at the same time as the Great Assembly is losing confidence in the high priest, because the high priest office is being basically bought and sold as a diplomatic position in many ways. And so you can see now that you have this overlapping of events when you kind of go, oh, okay. So then they instituted this Nasi, this president, who was not necessarily the Kohen Gadol. And so I hope you see that. So after Hillel the Elder, which is the one we talked about earlier, it's the late first century into the early first century, just a little before Yeshua. The Nasi, after Hillel the Elder, the Nasi, or the president, was almost never not a grand descendant of Hillel. So Hillel's legacy was very, very strong, and all of the Nasis after Hillel were usually his descendant. The second highest ranking member we talked about before is called the Av Beit Din, or head of the court. Father of the House of Judgment is the literal translation. And he presided over the Sanhedrin and actually sat as a member. And he sat especially during criminal court. In some cases, it was only necessary for a 23-member panel functioning as a lesser Sanhedrin. Remember, Katana. In general, the full panel of 71 judges was only convened on matters of national significance, like a declaration of war or something like that, or in the event that a 23-member subcommittee, subpanel, could not reach a conclusive verdict. And they brought in everyone. And again, we'll see more of that stuff afterwards. So that takes us kind of up through the First Temple period. So looking just really quickly past that, again, this is just the overview that we're getting into. So post-temple history, after the destruction of the Second Temple in 70, the Sanhedrin was reestablished in Yavne, so moved from Jerusalem. It moved out of the Hall of Hewn Stone into another place and on the outside of the temple, on Har Habayit, the Temple Mount. And then after the destruction of the temple, it moved to Yavne. And of course, its authority kind of decreased. It wasn't sitting in the temple. There was no temple. Everything is really in a flux and an uproar. And so the Imperial Roman government and legislation recognized it only in a small way. Then it moved around a couple of places till then. We'll talk about that next week. I hope you guys enjoy this and find it helpful. We'll see you next week. Shalom, shalom.